Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E, and the David and Lucille Packard Foundation for the coverage of fisheries issues. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, an innovative plan driven by citizens to clean up the air along the U.S.-Mexican border sets a precedent for international cooperation. We'll hear how it copes with the environmental anarchy created when two countries meet. How do we use the air? People in almost all civilizations seek to soar with the eagles. One way to let your spirits fly has been practiced for thousands of years. The air is just one element we seek to protect. Corporations and individuals are learning that preventing waste through reduction and reuse can help the environment and the bottom line. And the Earth calendar celebrates a relatively good year for the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle living along the Texas coast. They're the most endangered sea turtle in the world. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Last month, the U.S. and Mexico entered into an agreement to clean the air in the basin containing the cities of El Paso, Texas, and Juarez in the state of Chihuahua. The agreement is the first to tackle pollution problems in an airshed which is split by the border between two countries. Also unique is that citizen representatives from the community, and not connected with either government, are expected to play a major role in developing the strategy to clean the air. Juarez and part of El Paso lie in a basin with mountains around it. Octavio Chavez, professor at Monterey Tech, who worked on the process from the Mexican side, describes what the air in the basin is like.
What we have here is a basin that is surrounded by mountains to some extent. It's a valley. Most of Juarez is in the valley, and you have El Paso, Texas, which is half in the valley and half is above the valley, but still against one of the mountains. And then you have Sunland Park, New Mexico, which is also part of this international metropolitan region, which is on the west side of the basin, right outside the basin, but facing the desert. All the west side of Sunland Park is basically desert. We have a very dry climate. We have once in a while we have dust storms. We had one yesterday, a fairly bad. It gets as bad as almost covering the sun. Once the sun storm comes by, it's like getting a cloudy day. So the issues here in terms of air, we have a particulate matter problem, which is dust, basically, and also a product of vehicles, smoke, and industry is very, very limited impact on, has very limited impact on particulate matter, other than brick makers, which is another issue in the region. And then we have also the issue of carbon monoxide, primarily from vehicles, and we have ozone.
The important thing, says Chavez, is to deal with the environmental anarchy that the border creates.
Our effort has been toward the creation of an international air quality management body. Both sides of the border are crowded with agencies and officers and laws and regulations. But once you get to the border, what we actually have there is a lawless line. That is, that line does not have any law that or regulation that prevent pollution to go across. I mean, you don't need pollution, don't need papers to get from the U.S. to Mexico or from Mexico to the U.S. So we need to do something regionally to assure that the whole region is under regulation to reduce pollution.
The agreement calls for the establishment of a group to develop a work plan to improve the air. Pete Emerson, senior economist from the Environmental Defense Fund, says the structure is unique because of the number of local citizens involved.
The committee is going to be made up of 20 people. There will be 10 people from each country, and 5 individuals from each country will be from the private sector residing in the air basin. This is a pretty big development over other committees that work in the border region, which are typically dominated by federal officials from the two countries. Because of the international boundary that one has to deal with in addressing these environmental problems. So the fact that we have 10 non-government people on the committee and people who live in the air basin is quite important. Our strategy is that this is a regional air pollution problem, that the problem will only be solved if people who live and work in the two cities and in the region take responsibility for solving the problem and accept accountability for getting that done.
Formation of the committee is now underway. Tom Martin, who worked on the agreement and is the environmental manager of ASARCO, a company which operates a copper smelter in El Paso, hopes the process can get air cleanup projects started.
We're hoping to be achieved through the agreement is just a mechanism to share information, maybe set up some emission trading possibilities where companies on the U.S. side could expand and trade emission credits for the Mexican side, or maybe facilitate such things as supplemental environmental projects whereby a company to offset, say, a penalty from one of the agencies would opt to spend money on environmental project and facilitate to do this in Mexico. Traditionally, this is just done in the area where they are, but see if we can do this in Mexico. The idea being to funnel money there. Also would be to identify projects that we could get done for the that we get the most, as I said before, most bang for the buck, because there's a lot of opportunities, things as simple as paving streets. The whole issue is money, so we're going to be looking at avenues to funnel money in these projects and get them done.
All of the citizens who participated in the process said the biggest obstacle in reaching an agreement was overcoming the concerns of the governments about relinquishing sovereignty. Everybody shared a common interest in making sure money and effort spent produces the maximum results. For example, dollars spent paving dusty streets in Juarez might make the air cleaner than increasing sweeping of paved streets in Texas. The El Paso Ciudad Juarez agreement breaks new ground. By giving citizens an official role in working with their governments to stop air pollution in the basin, they may overcome the barriers of sovereignty and conflicting legal systems and national borders that air pollution refuses to recognize in the first place. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or hear any of our last four shows via the Internet. Go to our webpage at www.wamc.org/env and click on Listen to The Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env. There's a lot more to air than just particulate matter and volatile organic compounds. As well as breathing air, people play in it, pray to it, and have always been fascinated by it. Humankind in legend and in sport has devised ways to be in the air or fly things in it. More than 3,000 years ago, Chinese were using kites for religious and recreational purposes. Today, there's an international festival, and people make kites dance to music. This year, the largest festival will be in Japan. Tom Crouch is the chairman of the Department of Aeronautics at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., which maintains a significant collection of kites.
I think it's just the sheer delight of seeing something that you've built, you know, rise up into the air and the color and, you know, the feel of the wind on the kite communicated to your hand through the string and so on and so forth. Flight's something that's always fascinated human beings. And, you know, the kite was one of the earliest ways in which a human being could sort of taste the sensation of flight and make something that would actually take to the air. There is an enormous sense of pleasure connected to kites. They were enormously useful and instructive at the same time. Kites inspired the generations of engineers and technicians who were ultimately going to invent the airplane.
Kites are fun. They're also a valuable learning tool, teaching basic aeronautics, construction skills, and motivating students of all ages to celebrate the air around us. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. One business gathers what another one spills and makes money doing it. And our Earth calendar celebrates an improvement for the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle along the Texas coast. A greater number of them returned this year to lay eggs. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. One of the best ways to lessen our impact on the environment is by following the three R's. Not the kind you learned in school, but the environmental R's. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. Not only will these principles save the Earth unnecessary use of resources, but it will also save money. Multinational corporations and individuals alike have learned that paying attention to how they use resources can make a big difference for the environment and for the bottom line. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
It's basic common sense, but in a world that values consumption over conservation, common sense can seem like last year's fashions. Each year, Americans throw away tons of food and clothing and other materials, wasting energy and other valuable resources that take a significant toll on the environment. In an effort to slow this wanton consumption, environmentalists have devised a convenient guide.
Now, if you look at the solid waste hierarchy, it's reduce, reuse, recycle. It's important that we start teaching people about moving up that hierarchy. And what we do is we look at all of our inputs and all of our outputs. And ultimately, obviously, the goal is to minimize our inputs for maximum output of finished product. And to have the goal, obviously, is to only be sending out the back door finished product, because anything going out in any other form, either it's recycling or solid waste, is essentially lost profits. Anything that we're bringing in, we're paying for. Anything going out the back door, not as product, is lost profit. So that's one way for a lot of companies to look at it. For those people in particular having a hard time getting top management support to do environmental efficiencies, to look at it in terms of cost efficiencies.
Nancy Hirschberg is the environmental coordinator at Stonyfield Farm, a yogurt company in New Hampshire. Her company is one of many discovering that following the solid waste hierarchy can bring higher profits. For instance, Stonyfield Farm could throw away their old cardboard boxes, but they'd have to pay for disposal. Selling the boxes for recycling brings about $25 a ton. Selling them for reuse yields about $150 a ton. The benefit to the environment is that trees and energy are saved. Of course, reducing the need for boxes or any other material altogether would save even more money. They're working on that, as is Quad Graphics, the largest privately owned magazine printing company in the Western Hemisphere, based in Sussex, Wisconsin.
Waste ink, which is inherent to the printing process, that back in 1989 we were generating about 16 drums a month for one of our facilities, and which was about the average generation for a plant that size. Well, what we did is we began to look at the full costs associated with waste management, not just the transportation and disposal costs, but the liabilities associated with waste. You know, what it was costing us labor-wise to label drums, move drums, store drums, loss of floor space, all these costs, and in particular, the loss of raw material. Ink at $2 per pound, there's 500 pounds per drum. That's $1,000 in raw material, $16,000 a month that we were losing. So we brought in the press people, we brought in the management staff, and communicated this all to them and challenged them to go back to find ways to reduce waste ink, you know, and what was causing ink to become contaminated and preventing its further use. And how can we get that down to the minimum amount? You know, how can we reduce it or reuse ink? And then we'll talk about recycling. Within the first year of the program, we saved over $500,000 just in raw material alone.
John Imes is the environmental manager for Quad Graphics. By rooting out waste for both bottom line and environmental reasons, Quad has seen astronomical growth since it started about 25 years ago. But the benefits of reduce, reuse, and recycling is not just limited to corporations. Individuals can also see benefits. David Goldbeck is the author, along with Nikki Goldbeck, of Choose to Reuse. He says reusing resources is nothing new, but the need to reuse is new.
And what I'm trying to do, and what Nikki and I are trying to do in Choose to Reuse, is to get people to factor reuse options more and more into their decision-making, whether it's for personal use, whether it's for a business or a government. There are plenty of reuse options which have many, many different benefits.
Now, someone listening to this might say cynically, well, this is common sense. Why are we even talking about this?
Well, it is common sense. There's no question about it. And what I have found in my work is that sometimes what we're doing is not so much teaching people, but reminding people that this is something that they can do. And I constantly forget, despite the fact that I'm the co-author of Choose to Reuse, I'm constantly forgetting to bring my canvas bag to the supermarket. I have to develop those practices and reminders to do those things.
Goldbeck says we need to shift our thinking from looking at resources separate from all that went into making them. This means factoring in the environmental impact of extracting, manufacturing, transporting, packaging, and selling a product from dump trucks to Tic Tacs.
I'll just go through the benefits of reuse as compared to recycling. They both keep things out of the landfill. But at that point, there are vast differences. And the second main improvement of reuse over recycling is that it preserves what's called the embodied energy in that object, which is the energy that went into making that object in the first place. So, for example, if it takes about the equivalent of 7 gallons of gasoline to make a tire, it only takes about half that amount of gasoline to retread that tire.
Just as individuals can pass their unneeded resources along to others, corporations can practice this on a larger scale. Both Quad Graphics and Stonyfield Farm are looking into building a so-called eco-industrial park. No industrial process is without environmental impact, but if, for instance, wastewater can be reused or energy reduced, both money and the environment would be conserved.
Well, an eco-industrial park basically mimics the synergies and the complex webs that exist in ecology, where waste equals food for another entity.
Stonyfield Farm's waste water could become the input for rinsing the plastics for a recycling organization. This new way of looking at industrial systems is very different from industrial systems in the past, when there was this perspective that resources were limitless. Pollution and emissions and so forth weren't really an issue. Over the past, certainly 50 years, we've seen the impact of that. We've watched the shrinking resource base and certainly the impact of our waste on the environment. Eco-industrial park, the concept is to reduce the inputs and the outputs and to reuse them within the system.
Another way to follow the hierarchy is with our use of land. You may notice that today, most new buildings are on sites that used to be farms, forests, or other green space. The reason is that this land is nearly always clean, so the developer doesn't have to worry about removing what used to be there or dealing with the liability and headache of contamination. In order to make used land, especially industrial land, attractive, we need cheap and effective ways to clean or remediate soil and water. Phytotech, a company based in New Jersey, uses plants which suck up contaminants like heavy metals and paint. Bert Ensley is Phytotech's president.
Yes, the plants do become contaminated or come to contain heavy metals. That's what we want. So the way it works, we'll go onto a site, we'll grow the plants, the water moves through the soil and picks up the metals and goes into the roots of the plants, carrying the metals with it. The water travels up through the stems and evaporates from the leaves, leaving the metals behind. So the concentration of metals in the plant gets higher and higher until it's about 1% by weight, dry weight, of the plants is the heavy metals. At this point, we harvest the plant and we dry them. The plants are then transported off-site, and we treat them one of three ways, depending on what metals they are. They're either treated as hazardous waste in a hazardous waste treatment facility that's owned by some big company or like Rust or somebody, or the plants are deposited as waste in a permitted landfill. And finally, some metals like lead, we've been talking to large mining companies about smelting this as a very low-grade ore. If we smelt them, then we recycle the metals back into commerce.
Phytotech has even employed its methods near Chernobyl in Ukraine, site of the worst non-military nuclear accident ever. When the nuclear reactor caught fire there 10 years ago, hundreds of miles of land was contaminated. Today, whole towns and farming communities are abandoned because of it. Reclamating land around Chernobyl and land in your area would reduce, reuse, and recycle one of our most precious resources, land. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Every year about now, biologists on the coast of Texas wait to see if the endangered sea turtles will return to lay their eggs. The turtles once numbered in tens of thousands, but in just the course of a few decades, their number dropped to near extinction. This year, scientists have been encouraged by a surprise leap in the Kemp Ridley sea turtles, the most endangered of its kind in the world. Donna Shaver is with the National Biological Service, and she monitors the turtle population. She says there's been a comparatively good year.
This year so far in South Texas, we've had five Kemp's Ridley sea turtle nests that have been located. Five of those were at Padre Island National Seashore. Kemp's Ridley is the most critically endangered sea turtle species in the world, and location of five nests at the National Seashore is a record for us since we began maintaining records on nesting sea turtles in Texas. From 1979 to 1995, we only had seven confirmed Kemp's Ridley nests for the National Seashore.
When it's time to lay their eggs, turtles descend en masse to the beach where they are hatched. They scurry out of the water, lay the eggs, bury them with their hind legs, and race back to the water, never to see their offspring. This method has worked for millions of years, but around the 1940s, the turtles' fate changed. Shaver says several factors can be blamed for their decline.
Ranging from taking of eggs and nesting turtles on the beach several years ago to incidental capture through fisheries operations and other factors, entanglement in debris and things such as that have had impacts as well on the population. The eggs were collected at the nesting beach in Rancho Nuevo, Mexico, primarily by people from that country. It was thought that the eggs were aphrodisiacs.
Bringing back the Kemp Ridley sea turtle has not been easy. It's taken over 20 years of work by biologists and protection under the Endangered Species Act and strict new rules for shrimpers. Although the Kemp Ridley is the most critically endangered of all sea turtles, other turtles along the northwestern section of the Gulf of Mexico are also threatened. Protecting the beaches where they lay their eggs and the water in which they live is the key to their survival. So if you're looking for an aphrodisiac, forget about turtle eggs. I hear they don't work anyway, even for turtles. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 339. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer and Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE, and by the David and Lucille Packard Foundation for support of fisheries issues. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.